Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu downplays the latest ceasefire proposal, while the U.S. remains confident Israel will accept the deal.
We are completely confident. It was an Israeli proposal. Obviously, it was a proposal that they developed in consultation with the United States and Qatar and Egypt, the three countries that have played the mediating role throughout this process.
Ukraine accuses China of pressuring countries into not attending a Ukraine peace summit in Switzerland.
Unfortunately, there are also attempts to disrupt the summit.
And young Europeans look at the past and think about the future of the European Union as EU elections approach.
On this 20th anniversary, Reuters spoke with young adults about the EU's impact on their lives.
Today is Tuesday, June 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe. On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu downplayed the immediate prospects for a ceasefire in the war with Hamas in Gaza, saying that a deal proposed by U.S. President Joe Biden to halt the fighting and release militant held hostages was a partial outline. Despite Netanyahu's reluctance to accept the terms, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller says the U.S. is confident Israel will accept the proposal, even as Hamas has yet to respond.
We are completely confident. It was an Israeli proposal. Obviously, it was a proposal that they developed in consultation with the United States and Qatar and Egypt, the three countries that have played the mediating role throughout this process, but this was ultimately an Israeli proposal. In terms of where it stands, it was submitted to Hamas on Thursday night. We have yet to hear a response. We obviously saw the statement that they put out, I think it was on Friday, but we haven't gotten a response back from them.
And families of hostages are pressuring Israel to accept the deal as the Israeli military confirms the deaths of more hostages held by Hamas. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports on four of those hostages.
The Israeli military is confirming the deaths of four men taken from their kibbutzes during the October 7th attack. Israeli Defense Forces spokesman Daniel Hagari says four families got the grim news.
Their loved ones were killed a few months ago during Hamas captivity in Gaza, and their bodies are still being held by Hamas.
Three of the men were in their 80s. They had been shown in December in a Hamas video begging for their lives. The fourth, a 51-year-old British Israeli citizen. Hagari says there are dozens more waiting for rescue.
We will keep on doing everything we need for their freedom.
In Jerusalem, a protest outside the prime minister's residence where Shay Dickman wants the ceasefire proposal adopted so her cousin in captivity can be released.
And for 125 families to reunite.
I'm Jackie Quinn.
While the U.S. continues to project confidence in the ceasefire talks, Israel continues to object to some of the terms, and pressure from across the globe has had little effect so far in bringing the conflict closer to an end. Here to talk about where these disagreements may be coming from is VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara.
So the Biden administration seems confident both Israel and Hamas will accept the terms of the ceasefire deal, but so far neither has accepted the deal, and Netanyahu believes the deal falls short of being acceptable as it stands. So what is missing from the ceasefire deal, according to Israel and Hamas? And why does the Biden administration think Israel and Hamas will accept the current deal?
So at this point, we don't know too much about what Hamas is saying missing from the deal, other than the fact that if you compare the deal that President Biden laid out, I mean, there's not a whole lot of details in terms of, you know, actual numbers of how many hostages will be released at what phase versus how many Palestinian prisoners, for example. There's none of that detail. But if we compare it to the ceasefire deal that Hamas has said they already accepted about 3 weeks ago, it's actually not a whole lot of different, other than the fact that what President Biden said, which was from phase one to phase two, if there is, as long as negotiations continue, the 6 week pause in fighting will also continue. That's as far as we know in terms of the difference between the current proposal that President Biden says Israel has accepted versus the deal that about 3 weeks ago Hamas said that they have accepted. Now, Israel, what they are saying is that they have not changed their conditions on how to reach a permanent ceasefire. It will only happen after their objectives are met, including destroying Hamas military and governing capabilities. So Why does the Biden administration think Israel and Hamas will accept the current deal? We don't know. We just know that at this point, the situation is such so that there's a whole lot of pressure on Hamas, and there's also a whole lot of pressure from on Netanyahu to accept this deal. I'm sure you've seen a lot of protests in Israel from hostage families saying, just accept this deal because we want to continue. We want to have our families back with us, these hostages. But of course, Netanyahu is also receiving a lot of pressure from his hardliners who say, nope, we are not going to stop fighting until Hamas is completely rooted out. And some people say even further than that, beyond Gaza. Some are saying that even, you know, in Lebanon with Hezbollah. So there's certainly a lot of pressure that's playing into the dynamics.
Netanyahu has been saying from the very beginning that destroying Hamas is central to the entire mission in Gaza. But the U.S. is saying that Hamas does not have the abilities that it had during the initial attack on October 7th, that it is no longer the kind of threat that Israel believes it is. So what is the difference between Hamas being defeated according to Israel and Hamas being defeated according to the U.S.? Because it seems like the U.S. thinks Hamas is defeated.
I think that's a really key question, because at the beginning of this war, both President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu agrees that we have a goal, which is to destroy Hamas. Now, 8 months later, it seems that President Biden is saying, okay, what you are saying, if we are to believe the numbers that Israel is, has given out, which is 15,000 militants, that's about half of Hamas fighting force have been killed. Thousands of others have been wounded. A significant portion of their tunnel network have been destroyed. Their command centers and so on have been destroyed. So President Biden is saying, essentially, you can stop now with the offensive, with the current, you know, large scale military offensive that's obviously taken a lot of civilian deaths, civilian casualties. He's saying that's enough. I mean, Hamas, according to President Biden, is no longer capable of carrying out large scale attacks on Israel like the one on October 7th. While, as you say, according to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is under pressure from a lot of his right-wing politicians, is saying that no, we are going to continue because the destruction of Hamas military and governing capabilities is still our number one goal.
Patsy, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wuttikuswara. Peace talks concerning the war in Ukraine are set to begin June 15th in Switzerland. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Singapore over the weekend for Asia's biggest security conference accused China of pressuring other countries into not attending the upcoming summit.
Disappointed that some world leaders have not yet confirmed their participation in the peace summit. Unfortunately, there are also attempts to disrupt the summit.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning rejected the accusation on Monday, saying China, quote, believes that all efforts conducive to the peaceful resolution of the crisis should be supported. China has been calling for a peace conference with equal participation of all sides, including Russia, which has not been invited. Russia also has called Zelensky's peace plan requiring Russian withdrawal from Ukrainian territories a non-starter. Meanwhile, the U.S. will be attending the Ukraine Peace Summit in Switzerland. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani has more.
Vice President Harris will represent the U.S. at a Swiss-organized global peace summit for Ukraine this month. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says more than 100 nations will attend the summit in Lucerne.
First, very strong step on the way to peace.
President Biden's due at a Los Angeles campaign fundraiser the same day, hosted by George Clooney and Julia Roberts. Asked if the president's absence sends a bad signal.
There hasn't been any single leader around the world who has supported Ukraine more and more stridently than Joe Biden.
White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says no matter who represents the U.S.,
there can be no question that Ukraine has no stronger backer than the United States.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. A lawyer for Pakistan's imprisoned former Prime Minister Imran Khan says an appeal court has acquitted him of leaking state secrets. Khan will, however, remain behind bars as he serves several prison terms following convictions in four cases and awaits other trials.
Khan was convicted in January of revealing state secrets for waving a confidential document at a rally. UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, says tens of thousands of children in Afghanistan remain affected by ongoing flash floods, especially in the north and west. Unusually heavy seasonal rains have been wreaking havoc on multiple parts of the country, killing hundreds of people and destroying property and crops. The UN Food Agency has warned that many survivors have no homes, no land, and no source of livelihood. China has quashed large-scale commemorations of Tuesday's 35th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown within its borders, but outside the country, commemorative events have grown increasingly crucial for preserving memories of the 1989 massacre in Beijing, in which government troops opened fire on pro-democracy protesters, resulting in hundreds, if not thousands, dead. Over the past few years, talks, rallies, exhibitions, and plays have emerged in the U.S., Britain, Canada, Australia, and Taiwan. These activities foster hope and counteract efforts to erase reminders of one of the darkest chapters in modern China's history. Hong Kong's decades-old annual vigil that mourned those who died has vanished after the enactment of a China-imposed security law. Donald Trump returns to political campaigning this week as the first convicted felon to run for U.S. president as a major party candidate. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at how voters are reacting to the verdict on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump supporters continued to cheer their candidate outside New York's Trump Tower a day after the former president was convicted of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in a scheme to illegally influence the results of his 2016 election. In the city's Chelsea neighborhood, voter Nicholas Warner says the conviction was horrible and the country needs a second Trump term.
When he was in office for 4 years, we had nothing like we have going on now with the war and everything else, or the freaking, you know, the economy and inflation. So I just would like him to come back so we can just take care of business like a businessman and get this country where it's got to go.
In Maryland, voter Arkady Lapidus says Trump's claim that his trial was rigged is not good for the Republican Party or for the country.
There is nothing until this party dumps Donald Trump, says we believe in elections, we believe in the courts, we believe in juries who hand down verdicts because they're our fellow Americans. Until the party wholesale, like, espouses American values as I see them, I will never vote Republican again.
Voter Margaret Barnes says that even with a felony conviction, Trump is more believable than Joe Biden.
Biden just strikes me as being fake, and he's just fake sentimentality, just telling stories as if he's this nice old man when, you know, it's just artificial. I don't believe him. It's insincere. And with Trump, he's bombastic, and he's, you know, in that world of gold toilets and champagne and caviar and golf courses and Saudi princes. But even though what he says can be offensive, I believe him a lot more.
In Colorado, voter Luda Golodnik says Trump's conviction is deserved, and she hopes it hurts his campaign.
The way that he speaks about women, the way that he treats other countries, the way that he talks about illegal immigrants, him being married to an immigrant also, it just, like, yeah, I think he needs to. He's had what he's had coming a long way.
In Nevada, voter Keith Dayton says the verdict has no impact on his vote.
I'm still voting for Donald Trump. I think this whole thing has been a mockery. I'm embarrassed for our country. I wouldn't have him over for a beer or go to the pub with him. But that's not what it's about.
In the electoral swing state of Pennsylvania, the verdict may boost Trump supporters, says voter Jeffrey Nesbitt.
I think it would be much more effective for the American people to just beat him and his movement at the polls. I think that there's a good possibility that this verdict may motivate his movement to come out and vote even more aggressively and act more aggressively in this upcoming election.
90% of registered Republicans still back Trump, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll. That remaining 10% of Republicans, now less likely to vote for Trump, could make a difference in a close election where both candidates need to hold their bases and win independent voters. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. U.S. President Joe Biden's son Hunter faces gun charges in Delaware in a case that begins 4 days after Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president to be convicted. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
The Delaware case is expected to center on Hunter Biden's years-long crack cocaine use and addiction, which he has discussed publicly and written about in a 2021 book. Prosecutors are expected to present videos and photos of him smoking crack, evidence that was collected from his iCloud account, laptop, and phone messages. The government said it may also call Hunter Biden's ex-wife Kathleen Buell and other romantic partners to describe his addiction. If convicted on all charges in the Delaware case, Hunter Biden faces up to 25 years in prison, though defendants generally receive shorter sentences, according to the U.S. Justice Department. There are potential political consequences, too, as the trial gives Republicans a chance to shift attention away from the numerous legal troubles of their party's presidential candidate, Donald Trump. Last week, Trump was convicted in New York of 34 felony counts of falsifying documents to cover up hush money paid to a porn star shortly before the 2016 election that put him in the White House. Trump is due to be sentenced on July 11th and has pleaded not guilty in three other pending criminal cases.
That was Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. South Korea plans to convene in mid-June a public UN Security Council meeting on human rights abuses in North Korea, Seoul's UN envoy said on Monday. It's a move likely to anger Pyongyang and draw opposition from Russia and China. South Korean Ambassador Hwang Jun-kook said he hoped there would be significant support among council members to hold a meeting, noting that the issue of human rights in North Korea is formally on the Security Council's agenda.
The advancement of the DPRK's WMD program is closely intertwined with the dire human rights and humanitarian situation in the country, like two sides of the same coin. In this regard, we firmly believe that the Security Council should not neglect the latent risks that systematic human rights violations in DPRK pose to international peace and security. Human rights and peace and security issues should be approached in a holistic manner, especially in the case of the DPRK.
The North Korean, Russian, and Chinese UN missions in New York did not immediately respond to a request for comment. North Korea has repeatedly rejected accusations of abuses and blames sanctions for a dire humanitarian situation. Since 2006, it has been under UN sanctions over its ballistic missile and nuclear programs, but there are 8 exceptions. A landmark 2014 UN report on North Korean human rights concluded that North Korean security chiefs and possibly leader Kim Jong-un himself should face justice for overseeing a state-controlled system of Nazi-style atrocities. The United States sanctioned Kim in 2016 for human rights abuses. Claudia Sheinbaum, a Nobel Prize-winning climate scientist, will become Mexico's first female president after winning a landslide election victory and promising to continue the work of her mentor and outgoing leader, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
A major step for Mexico, a country known for its macho culture and home to the world's second biggest Roman Catholic population, which for years pushed more traditional values and roles for women.
No llego sola. Llegamos todas.
I didn't get here on my own. We all got here together, our female heroes, who created the nation, our female ancestors, our mothers, our daughters, and our granddaughters.
Felicito a todas y a todos los mexicanos.
38 candidates have been murdered during the campaign, reinforcing massive security problems the country faces. And 2 people were killed at polling stations in the Puebla state on Sunday. Sheinbaum has vowed to improve the situation, but has given few details. She has also promised to expand the welfare policies that have driven her predecessor López Obrador's popularity and contributed to her triumph. However, a hefty budget deficit and low economic growth will make it tricky.
That was Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. Hundreds of millions of European Union citizens will be able to vote June 6th to the 9th to choose the 720 members of the next European Parliament. Young Europeans reflect on past promises and future hopes for the bloc, 2 decades since most of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe joined the EU in 2004. Ilyan Rubens from Reuters has more.
20 years ago, in 2004, most of Central and Eastern Europe joined the European Union.
Today, the bloc is made up of 27 nations and almost 450 million people. On this 20th anniversary, Reuters spoke with young adults about the EU's impact on their lives and their vision for its future ahead of European Parliament elections in June. In the Polish capital city of Warsaw, 19-year-old Julia Klimkiewicz embraces the opportunities she says the EU has provided her.
I see the possibilities the European Union gives me because I was born in the European Union and I can travel freely across the EU. I can go on foreign student exchanges as part of the Erasmus program.
Meanwhile, in the Polish countryside, 19-year-old farmer Damian Kreiser points out the unequal treatment Eastern European countries receive from the EU, particularly in terms of agricultural subsidies.
Eastern Europe is being treated in a different way by the European Union, and unfortunately you can see on the international stage that we don't have as strong a say, and we are being treated differently. For so many years, direct subsidies to farmers were supposed to be equal, but it hasn't been done yet. Western countries still have higher subsidies.
He says he's also concerned about the EU's environmental policy, saying it could undermine the bloc's economy. The EU has pledged to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. The young people also spoke about their hopes as well as fears ahead of the EU Parliament elections in June, when many of them will be able to vote for the first time.
I think that the future of the European Union is focused around the target of building a clever migration policy, but also around reinforcing the European army. After the war in Ukraine started, we saw how naive a solution it is to rely solely and exclusively on NATO.
Ilyan Rubens from Reuters. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
3 years into the crisis in Burma, or Myanmar, the humanitarian situation continues to rapidly deteriorate. According to the United Nations, over the past 12 months, the number of people in need of humanitarian assistance has risen from 17.6 million to 18.6 million, while the number of the internally displaced has increased by two-thirds, from 1.8 to 3 million. And it's the young, the children, who have been hit the hardest. Children in Myanmar are suffering from displacement, interrupted education, injury, food insecurity, and unexploded ordinances, said Linda Thomas Greenfield, U.S. Permanent Representative at the UN.
Myanmar's children face the brunt of the violence and will have to live with the consequences of this conflict for decades to come. And so we must prioritize protection of children in our approach. We must prioritize the protection of children. And we must put our full support behind those that are leading the way toward a more peaceful and more democratic future for Myanmar, especially young leaders and pro-democracy groups.
Recently, the Burmese military government implemented a 2010 conscription law, which the regime is reportedly using to draft thousands of Rohingya men and boys. This conscription takes advantage of a highly vulnerable community, and it will only foment fear, mistrust, and violence, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
We must call on the military and all parties to the conflict to prioritize the protection of all civilians and to allow unhindered humanitarian access to populations in need in line with their obligations under international humanitarian law.
Finally, we are watching with growing alarm the worsening situation in Rakhine between the regime's military and the Arakha army, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. Just 5 months into 2024, the regime has conducted more airstrikes than in 2022 and 2023 combined.
Since the beginning of this year, Myanmar's military regime has carried out nearly 1,000 airstrikes across the country, averaging 6 strikes each day. 1 out of 5 of the regime's airstrikes target Rakhine State, with a third hitting civilians. And in the midst of this fighting, Rohingya communities once again bear the brunt of the violence.
The United States supports an inclusive dialogue to return Myanmar to the path of representative democracy in line with Resolution 2669, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. Only through a comprehensive approach and global action will we find a peaceful and just conclusion to this horrific conflict at long last.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.